Tonight, we've got Isaac. He's got his blue chip. It's been a heck of a year. I'm just a couple of months in front of Isaac. Boy, he works a great program. He's a great dine rep. He's involved all over this club. So let's give everybody give a warm welcome to Isaac.
Good evening. My name is Isaac, and I'm a real alcoholic. I want to thank everyone for coming tonight. People would have to get pretty liquored up in order for them to hear my life story, so I appreciate this. A little bit of my background. My great granddaddy was an alcoholic. My granddad was an alcoholic, and both my parents met in the program of Narcotics Anonymous. So, that said, I was doomed before I was a twinkle in my daddy's eye. My sobriety date is August 21st, 2007. And I was born on June 19th, 1987. So I was 20 years old when I got sober. I was born in Santa Rosa, California, which is about an hour northeast of San Francisco. And my dad died in 1989 when I was 2 years old, and it was a tough life from that point on. My mom suffered from a great deal of depression. I remember coming home, and she would be, almost every time, she'd be upstairs in her room crying. But to be quite honest, those were the best days of my life. I was never closer with my family than at that time in my life when it was just me and my mother. I have a lot of other people in my family that are in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I knew about the 12 steps at an early age. I moved, not a lot, but I moved a little bit. Finally, when I was in second grade, I moved down to Catalina Island. And from that time, I can only remember having 2-3 friends in Santa Rosa. I was in my own little world, shall we say. I wasn't a sociable person. So I moved to Catalina Island. I got there with no friends, and I left there with no friends. It was just me and my mom for a long time. And it wasn't bad. I mean, there was hardly any food in the refrigerators, you know. She worked at YMCA for minimum wage. The only way we really got by was that my grandmother was our landlady, so she would let us slide on the rent. My dad left us a lot of debt, and it was tough. But like I said, I'd never been any closer to my family at any other point in my life. So, moved down to Catalina Island. Nothing special. Wasn't good at making friends, so I didn't even bother. My mom met my stepdad, and that was the beginning of another life. Not necessarily a better one, but a different one. I was thrown into a life of, you know, we weren't rich, we weren't wealthy, we didn't have a lot. And I was content. I was thrown into a world where my stepdad made a pretty good living. I was thrown into this world where there was spare money. You know, my dad had money. My mom and my stepdad, they started their own family. I actually have 3 brothers and 3 sisters. My dad was married 4 times before he married my mom, and I don't know where my oldest brother and my 2 older sisters are. Last time I heard, my older brother was in St. Louis, and that was back when I was about 6 years old. But my mom and my stepdad started a new family, and they had 2 boys and a daughter, my little brothers and my sisters, and I love them more than anything else in the world. And then we moved from Catalina Catalina Island to Orange County, Southern California. And I was always the weird kid in class, you know? Some girls would giggle when other kids would walk by. They would ask me, "Why are you so weird? What's wrong with you?" You know, that kind of stuff. So that was pretty detrimental to my self-esteem. So I had no problem being by myself. I thought it was weird. I never really fit in anywhere. I read a lot of books, and I enjoyed my own company, which later would turn out to be fatal, almost, you know. And so I went on through elementary school and middle school as a weird kid with hardly any friends. And then I went into high school, and that's where it started. I was 14, probably September, October of that year, when I first started high school. I took my first drink, and my friend had stolen a bottle from his dad of tequila, and we drank that whole bottle that night. And it was fun. I don't doubt it. It was probably one of the best times I had in my life. And the way that alcohol made me feel was like nothing I've ever felt before. So I drank through high school. I barely graduated high school, you know, just by a 2.0. Anything less, I would have failed. Because I was either drunk when I was there, which was hardly, but I never really showed up. You know, before I had taken a drink, my dream was to go to UCLA and to become, I don't know, anything, you know, but I wanted to go to a four-year university. And as my drinking progressed over the years, I went to a state college, then a junior college, and I said, screw college, I don't need that. But I did, I graduated and I did try to go to college. I was going to go major in music, and I went for two semesters and I dropped out because it got in the way of my drinking. Tried again for water distribution, still got in the way of my drinking. And by that time, once I got out of high school and I turned 18 and I was legally an adult, that's when my life started to go downhill. I started having run-in with the law. I was a thief. I couldn't hold a job. So I went a lot without having a job and living off of stolen liquor. I would go and steal my liquor from out in California, you know, the grocery stores and Rite Aid and all that. They carried liquor. And the cheap vodka was the easiest to steal, so I drank that. And once I got out of high school, it was nonstop. I didn't have a job, wasn't going to school, what the hell? You know, I might as well just drink myself to oblivion. And I did that for, I leased off of my parents, and it was bad, it was bad. They had wanted to kick me out when I was 16, and I was able to stay there till I was 19. I'm pretty good at manipulating and taking advantage of people. But I stayed there till I was 19, and they pretty much kicked me out. They said, you can't stay here anymore. And the only person who was willing to take me was my aunt. I had nowhere to go, so I came out here to Georgia, to Atlanta. It was going to be a new start, you know, different state, different type of people. It was a whole new experience for me. I'd never lived outside of California. I got here within 6 months. I'd been thrown into the tank and got kicked out of my place. My aunt kind of kicked me in and out. I came home drunk every night. You know, that was me. You know, there wasn't a time when I wasn't drunk. And she's actually an Alcoholics Anonymous, so it was not looked kindly upon when I would come home plastered. She tried to kick me out a couple times, but I guess she just felt sorry for me and let me come back a few other times until finally I had blacked out, and that was my last drink. Me and my friend had drank a gallon of Captain Morgan's rum, And then we went down to Ms. McHugh's pool hall and had a few pitchers of beer, and that's the last thing I remember. Next thing, I wake up in DeKalb County in the tank. I didn't know how I got there. And the drunks were telling me that I had to stop drinking. And that made me mad because they were there for public intoxication as well. Though I didn't know what I was being charged with at the time, mind you. So I got out of jail, out of the tank, and I remember standing on Memorial. I had nowhere to go. I had no money. I didn't have a job. And I was in the middle of Atlanta where I didn't know anybody. Like I said, I wasn't good at making friends, so I didn't have any contacts when I moved out here because I had only been staying out here for 6 months. And so one thing that I had always looked for in my life when I was drinking, in my drinking career, was to be completely alone. Why won't anyone just leave me alone? Let me drink and get drunk. I wasn't a rowdy person when I got drunk. Maybe in a blackout, I can't say. But I got out of jail, and that feeling of complete isolation, you know, and nowhere to go, was the worst feeling I've ever felt in my life. Something that I'd strived for a long time, and I achieved it, and I did not like it. As a matter of fact, it scared me. So I stayed the night in a motel, and I remember sitting in that motel smoking cigarettes and watching SpongeBob SquarePants because I didn't know what else to do. And I finally went to my aunt and asked her for help to take me to one of these so-called AA meetings. And she did. She said, "I don't believe you. And I don't think you're going to stay sober, but I'll take you there." And she did, and it was on a Monday at 5:45, and I cannot tell you what went on in that meeting. But I can tell you what happened after that meeting. And before that meeting, there was a couple people that came, that my aunt pretty much shoved me in front of and but she's like, "You got to talk to these people." And I did. And a revelation came upon me that these people wanted to help me, and they didn't want anything in return except that I stay sober and keep coming back. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me, because no one wanted to ever do anything for me. And especially no one wanted me to come back to anywhere. I was very disrespectful in public areas and in people's houses. You know, I was, and I still am, very self-centered and self-seeking. And from that moment on, after that 5:45 meeting, I stayed for the speaker meeting at 8 o'clock, and I can't tell you who spoke. And my aunt gave me the choice. I could go with her home after the 5:45 or stay, so I stayed for the 8 o'clock. And my warped mind, I thought I could walk from here to Doraville within 20 minutes. So I started walking. And on the way, someone picked me up and they said that I can go and detox at their house. I was shaking pretty bad when I came in, and I could only have a half a cup of coffee. And so I went with them. And what he said to me was, "You can detox at my house for free." And free was my middle name. I liked free stuff, and I knew that treatment centers and all that, it would cost me money, and I didn't have medical insurance. So I went with them, and I stayed with that particular group for 1 or 2 weeks, and they helped me out, and I appreciate that. They gave me what I needed at the time, and then I had to move on. And I asked, that guy that picked me up and took me to his house to detox was my first sponsor, and he started my foundation. He took me to a lot of meetings, And I was able to talk to alcoholics and try to be as honest as I could, which wasn't very honest. And you know, within my first 30 days, I had a lot of reservations. I didn't really want to do this thing. You know, I was convinced I was an alcoholic. That first step made complete sense to me. I had no trouble with that step. But I didn't realize the effects of alcoholism on other people's lives. And then around 30 days, a good friend of mine who I had met when I came in, and, you know, he was as close as I had gotten to someone in ever. You know, it wasn't real close, but it was close as from what I perceived it as. He ended up dead. He drank Listerine. He went back out and started drinking Listerine and died. And that, it was sad for me, but at the same time it was an eye-opener. It showed me what this illness, actually is, and what it can do to people. They say a jealous institution, but if you keep on doing it, you'll wind up dead. And he wasn't the first that I've seen dead. And I don't think he's going to be the last. So I asked another particular man to be my sponsor. And this man helped me out tremendously. And I love him with all my heart still. He took me through a lot of the steps. The first three steps were not a problem. I had gone to church before to try to stop drinking, but it just didn't work. Church is not my thing. I believed in God, but I didn't necessarily agree with dogma or creed of organized religion. And that's just my personal belief. Now, whatever your conception of God is probably the right one. But mine, I can't explain to you, and I cannot tell you how he works in my life. It just happens. But the first three steps were not hard for me, because the only hard part about the first three steps was the second step. And it wasn't coming to believe in a power greater than myself. It was that I was insane. I did not think I was insane. Stealing liquor and drinking bottles of liquor every day was normal. That's what everyone else that I knew did. That's how we lived. We jumped job from job, staying drunk the whole time. It was not an uncommon thing where I come from. But what helped me out was that the insanity had to be focused on my drinking. Nothing was ever accomplished. I couldn't stop drinking, and it made me miserable, yet I still drank. For the past 3 years, there were a lot of drinks that I did not want to take, but I did because I didn't know what else to do. That was my way of living, was living drunk. I had no life skills when I came in. I didn't know how to live life, you know. So I came in and I took those first three steps. But it was the fourth step that the real action actually began. In the 12 and 12, it pretty much, it's paraphrased, but the first three steps don't really require action. They only require acceptance. But when I got to that fourth step, that's when the real work started. And I wasn't scared of doing it. There was a little bit I was scared of. But I remember making a mountain out of a molehill and sitting there trying to think and trying to be thorough, but I was just blank-headed and I couldn't think of anything. And I finally asked my sponsor, you know, what do I do? And he said, just do it. This is not going to be your last fourth step that you do. And so I did it. I put down the rest of my thoughts, and I did my fifth step as soon as possible. And that was something that my dad, my real dad, used to say, is that it is imperative that you do your fifth step immediately after you do your fourth step. And it says it in the big book, whoever does not finish this step is likely to drink again. So I did it. because I didn't want to go back to that way I was living, where I was drunk all the time. And I didn't know where I was half the time and what I did. So I did it. And I did the sixth and I did the seventh step. And you know, the sixth and seventh step is the meat and potatoes for me. Because that's the area where I still need to work on a lot. I still have a lot of defects of character. You know, there's still a lot of me that is still very screwed up. But so long as I stay sober, I'm all right. You know? And, you know, the eighth and ninth step. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. I got to my eighth step, and that sponsor that I love so very dearly, he relapsed on me. And he didn't relapse on me. He relapsed on himself. And it hurt very, very much. Like I said, I love that man. And that was another thing that I learned in this program, is to love other men and women. To love them. And not just put on that show that, oh yeah, I love you because you got liquor. And I don't. And I need some. And there was a lot of other stuff that happened too. I think my pink cloud, as they say, lasted about 5 or 6 months, maybe 7, I can't really remember. But it ended pretty quick. I remember going back when I had about 9 months back to California to visit my family. And my plan, I was going out for 8 days, and my plan was to visit my uncle, who's in the program. He's got about 32 years. And stay with him for a couple days and stay with my family for the rest of the week. So I went out there and I stayed with my uncle. And I was only able to stay with my family for 2 days. And I had to go back to my uncle's house. Because just because I'm better doesn't mean my family is. And it was a very difficult thing for me to do. You know, there was no arguing or yelling or anything. It was just, I wasn't the problem anymore. Or at least I wasn't the major problem anymore. It was the family dynamic that is still very dysfunctional to this day. So I went out to California and I visited my folks. And it was nice. I enjoyed it. And to the time I was able to, until I started going crazy and regressing back to my old self. So I went and stayed with my uncle, and he took me to some meetings out there, and I was able to get back in balance, you know. And I came back, and about a week after I get back, see, I inherited some money from my great uncle, whom I'm named after, and it was a good chunk of change. And about a week after I get back, my stepdad says that he needs to borrow it. And I say, okay. I talk to a few people. And they say, well, if his intent in using that money is with good cause, let him. And I said, okay. And I investigated it a little bit more. And I did some sleuthing. And found out that he had stolen it from me about 3 years ago. And that was that hurt more than anything else. You know, a little bit of it was my fault because I was drunk and I didn't check up on it and I didn't want to take responsibility for it. But the fact that my stepdad would do that to me. You know, my parents were really the only people I trusted when I was drinking, and that was, you know, that was not a lot of trust I put. They didn't trust me. So for him to tell me that, it hurt. It hurt a lot. And I had to pray and I had to meditate. And that's when a lot of calamity came back into my life. From that moment on. Because I had two people say, well, you just got to accept that you might not see that money back. And I had other people telling me to take legal action. And it was a crazy time in my life. But anyways, so that happened. And my relationship with my family is still a estranged relationship. And then I can't, with my work situation, I kind of got, you know, fired, I guess you could say. I was trying to think of a softer way to put it, but that's the word. I got fired from my job, and you know, that was, I didn't think much of it at the time until I got kicked out of the place I was staying because I didn't have a job and I wasn't making any money. Thank you. And it felt like when I got kicked out of my place, mind you, I was living with my aunt, and she kicked me out. And that was the same thing that happened when I was drinking, was I got kicked out. And it felt like I was at that same place that I was when I was drinking. It felt like I hadn't made any progress that night until I had to talk to a couple people and tell them, listen, you're sober, you've got spiritual principles, and you have people in your life that love you, that want to help you. And damn it, I almost broke out in tears when someone told me that. Because, like I said, no one had ever been there to help me to that extent. They might have helped me steal some liquor or steal some golf clubs and pawn them, you know, help me break into a house or something, but nothing to that extent, you know. And so I wanted to read something from the big book. It's on page 96 and working with others, and I actually came across this passage in a big book study that I have with my new sponsor today. And he's a very good man, and I love him too. And he's very grounded in the literature, which is a very good thing for me. And it's on page 97 and 98. For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust God and clean house. And I'm at a point in my life where I think I should be doing a little bit more footwork. And that there's a lot of work left in me to do. But I try to clean house to the best of my ability, and I rely upon God very heavily. Because an alcoholic of my type does not quit drinking by himself. I had tried it before, and it did not work. I remember I only tried it once and gave up after that. And I think I lasted about 4 days until I started sweating and shaking a little bit and white-knuckled it for that 4 days. Locked myself up in my room. And it was not pretty. And it did not feel good physically, mentally, emotionally. And I really didn't have a spiritual self then when I was drinking. But I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and with your guys' help and the help of God, I've been able to stay sober for a little bit. And it, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing. I think somewhere else in the 12 and 12 it says, I'm paraphrasing because I'm not good at memorizing stuff. I'm 21 years old and I've got the worst memory ever. And I have people to vouch for me on that. But in the 12 and 12 it says, paraphrasing, that it would take an act of providence to take that drink out of my hand. And that's what it took. Because on my own, I couldn't do it. It was impossible. And I think that's the difference between a real alcoholic and a heavy drinker. You know, it says in the big book, a heavy drinker with enough cause can put down the drink. He can put it down and not pick it up again. But the real alcoholic can't. The real alcoholic suffers from a physical allergy and a mental obsession. Now, I have both of those. I don't need to go back out to prove it. I remember very clearly what it was like when I was drinking. I could never have just two beers and relax and watch a movie. Two beers eventually turned into a bottle of vodka or something stronger. Because what I learned in one of my four steps, was that I was afraid of living life on life's terms. So what did I do? I hid away drunk. And, you know, I've learned a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still learning work ethics, which when I came in I did not have. I'm still learning honesty, you know. I try to be as honest as I can, but that's still another lesson that I need to learn. And humility pretty much has to be pounded into my head in order for me to experience just a little bit of it. And it's not often that that happens. Typically only through humiliation that I grasp a little bit of humility, which is needed in order for me to stay sober. But it is only by the grace of God that I'm sober here today and standing in front of you. And for those of you who think that you're not an alcoholic, you're here for a reason. You know, there was another man at the 5:45 meeting who had been in and out for quite a while. And I always think of this man. I remember talking to him after the meetings a lot. And, you know, we were acquainted and we would talk. Our conversations never got real deep. But this man was in and out for a long time. And the last time he went out, he didn't come back. He had died in his apartment. And he was lucky to have an apartment. And he had died and was found 5 days later by his son. And that really opened my eyes again to what this illness can do. Like I said, I'm lucky if I have an apartment that I would die in, you know. And that's the eventual bottom that alcoholism will take you to. Jails and institutions, you know, you can get out of those, but death, it's a one-way street. You don't come back from that. And it's a very, you know, my great-granddad and my granddad died from this disease. I never met them because they abandoned us, or at least my mom. But they died from this. And, you know, when I get close to people, and this is a hard thing for me still, is when I get close to people and they decide to go back out and research a little bit more. I have trouble grieving. That's something that I just learned about myself. Because when I was a kid, I was a crybaby. I was a crybaby. I ran home to mom and cried my eyes out to her when I was a kid. Then once I discovered liquor, I was unable to cry anymore. I was unable to feel any emotion anymore. And a lot of stuff happened when I was drunk. A lot of people in my family died. And it's usually around this time of year that they drop off. I'm still learning how to grieve about my father. I'm still learning to grieve about my aunt. And my aunt was in the program, and she was a dry drunk. And she eventually hung herself in her garage. And on Halloween, that'll be 2 years ago. And, you know, a few other people in my family have died. And what alcohol has done is taken away that ability in order for me to grieve. I remember at my aunt's memorial, I was unable to cry. And the only thing I could think about was taking a drink. You know, this lady who I had been with all my life and had supported me in everything I did, and she dies, and all I can do is think about getting drunk. And that's the first and only thing on my mind. So I come into the program, and I don't know how to cry. I don't know how to grieve about a death in my family or of someone that is very close to me. But like everything else, like the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it takes time and it's a process. And that's something that I'm learning also is patience and tolerance. You know, I don't necessarily love everybody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm willing to help them if they need help. I remember a man that I don't particularly care for calls me in the middle of the night because he's thinking about taking a drink. And instead of saying that you're an asshole and hanging up on him because I don't like him, I sat there and talked with him. Because I think that's what the 12 tradition says to me. Is that it's are you willing to help an alcoholic, you know, over anything else? Regardless if he's an asshole or not. Regardless about your feelings toward a certain person. Are you willing to help him when he calls you at 4 o'clock in the morning talking to you about taking a drink? Just because I don't like someone doesn't mean that I don't want to see another alcoholic die. You know? It's not something that I would want of anybody. And so, for me, I've had a few sponsorees that have... They've asked me to be their sponsor, and I said yes, and I'm sponsoree-less. For me, the most important thing, the basis of me coming in here was that I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. Any length. And that the first thing that I had to learn was don't take a drink no matter what. No matter what. Regardless if I'm alone and sad. And, or that, damn it, life is just too hard. You know, I know where alcohol takes me. I do not stay in a place of residence too long when I'm drinking. And I do not, no one wants to help me when I'm drinking. And from that basis that I came in on, I was able to achieve a lot in my life. It may not be materials. It may not be prestige, but something spiritual that I can't explain to you. And it's something that you have to experience for yourself. Because I can't put a finite image on God. I cannot explain to you the words of human language, what God has done in my life and how He does it. It's just too complicated and it's too extravagant. But He has worked in my life because I'm standing here sober today. And I think that's the most important part of my life. You know, so long when I drink liquor, it stunts my growth. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I don't progress. As a matter of fact, I go the opposite way. And it's not fun going on a roller coaster backwards. But so long as I don't take a drink, I'm okay. And I have plenty of room to grow. And that's what I'm working on right now, is improving the other aspects of my life rather than just my sobriety. Don't get me wrong, sobriety is my first priority, but it is not my only priority. And that's something that I heard when I first came in. You know, sobriety has to be your first priority, but don't let it be your only priority. Because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, mind you, I was not a part of life. I wasn't a part of it. But that, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, staying sober one day at a time, I was able to go back into the mainstream of life just a little bit. I'm getting closer and closer to that bozo on the bus kind of state of mind. If you're new, real quick, when I came in, I couldn't grasp a lot of what people told me about God, and as a matter of fact, the word God kind of didn't ring true to me. So if you're new, what was told to me was don't drink no matter what and go to meetings, and you'll hear the rest. You know, you'll learn what to do, but just in order for me to see God work in my life, I had to stick around a little bit. I couldn't stay for 2 weeks and say God wasn't working in my life. I couldn't do that, you know, because it's not on my time anymore. I've lived life on my time and on my standards, and it wasn't very pretty. So, if you're new, don't drink and keep coming back. Thank you all.
Thank you, Isaac. It's been a real growing experience for you. We're glad to be here with you. Seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Donations support the group in AA its own. And Terry, would you please give out the chips?
I'm not involved.